Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Stone Chapel, a podcast of the staff and friends of the Lanier Theological Library in Houston, Texas. My name is David Capes. I'm the Senior Research Fellow at the Library and your host for this series of podcasts. Our purpose is fairly simple. We want to bring to you great conversations with leading experts from around the world on biblical, theological, historical, and archaeological themes. Well, the list goes on. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Joining me today on the Stone Chapel is Dr. Scott Hauerwehr. He's Associate Professor of Theology and History at Ridley College in Melbourne, Australia. We're social distancing by about 12,000 miles today, so I think we're okay at that point. He's an Anglican minister. He's a painter, I just discovered today. He also plays a mean bass guitar. He tries to make it a nice bass guitar, but it's just a mean bass guitar. Hey, Scott, thanks for being with us today here on the Stone Chapel.
G'day, David. It's great to be with you. Thank you for that introduction.
Hey, we're talking about your book, God of All Comfort, A Trinitarian Response to the Horrors of This World, forward by Graham Cole, who's a friend of the Lanier Theological Library, published in 2019 by Lexham Press. Mm-hmm. It's a terrific book. I've looked through it this past 2 weeks, I guess. I've been reading it. And, you know, I was a little afraid about this book because, as you know, and as some of our listeners know, our adult son, Daniel, died in August of 2019 after a long and intense battle with cancer. And so we've been through our own horror. So a part of this book was I wanted to read it because I knew it would minister to me in some way. And I knew it was stuff that I needed to hear. It's been about 18 months since you passed away. So, but anyway, I'm really glad to have this conversation to talk with you about this book because I think it's a great book, an important book.
Thank you.
Again, the subtitle is A Trinitarian Response to the Horrors of This World. So what's the genesis? Where did this come from out of your history and experience and such?
Sure. Thank you, David. I grew up in Argentina as a missionary kid when a civil war was going on and people were being disappeared and there were bombs going off. So I grew up in a context in which the world was definitely not as it should be, a long way away from shalom, as Genesis 1 and 2 presents it.
Yeah.
When I returned to Australia, I became a nurse and I worked in intensive care and the trauma room in a hospital. And I realized that even in a lovely place like Australia, people were still experiencing tremendous horrors, dismemberment, assault of all kinds, and that, again, the world just was not as it was meant to be here in Australia. And as a Christian, I really struggled to reconcile the loving, holy God, the good shepherd who loves people, and these appalling calamities that left an awful trail of destruction in their wake. And so I guess one of my big concerns as a Christian, a human, as a pastor and a seminary lecturer is, where is God in the midst of all the wreckage that we see around us?
That may be one of the biggest questions that is as yet to be fully answered. I'm not sure we'll ever fully answer that, but at least I think you take an important step to help us at that point. Use the word horror. Why that word here in the title? And you use it often in the book. Why horror?
I find that when we use the word evil, it's just a little bit sanitized and a bit clinical. When I spend time with people whose children have been dismembered in a car accident or with someone who has been sexually assaulted, what's happened to them is a horror. It fundamentally inserts death into their life and reduces their capacity to live fully as an image of God. Life will not be the same. It means they aren't as available to other people as what they would be otherwise. So we all suffer. We all fail to flourish in a sense.
Yeah.
So what's happened to these precious images of God is that as moral, relational, creative creatures, we are essentially knocked off the rails and we simply aren't who we could be for one another. I think that's horrific, absolutely horrific. And it's not just horrific in terms of the image of God and the common good, but it's horrific in terms of the experience I mean, David, you know, when something hideous and appalling happens, there's a sense of natural disgust when you see someone in the wake of an assault or dying. It's just unnatural for us. We weren't made by God with the intention to handle the fact that our loved ones just wither away before us. There's nothing we can do. It is hideous and horrific in the experience itself. So that's why I use the language of horror. Also, I've noticed that in a sense, Netflix has been leading the way. Christians haven't really been dealing with the horrific, but Netflix has lots of series, zombie series, alien series, pandemic series, where they deal with these big questions. Does it matter if the human race gets partly wiped out? What does it matter if someone becomes a zombie? Are they really that different to being fully human? They ask these questions. We haven't been asking them. But I tell you, the one good thing, I'm not a horror movie watcher much, but I've noticed that people that write about horror, secular people, say, look, there is a good thing about the horror genre because it reminds us that the world is fundamentally unsafe and unpredictable. And as Christians, I think we need to be able to hold God's hand amidst the seemingly unpredictable and random nature of life, and to be reminded that the world is a fallen world in which there are demonic agents, there are people with appalling intentions for one another, and really this is not our home. But we need to navigate this world together with God and one another. And the worst thing we can do is embrace the Netflix view that the world is fully unsafe and unpredictable and there's really no good shepherd to guide us through. So I wanted to write a book that said, look, God cares, he's involved, he can restore safety, self and community in the wake of trauma. And that largely involves us Christians being there for one another as we can in the midst of horrors and trauma.
I think one of the things that for us has been so important have been the people whom God has sent our way to be friends and to accompany us through this. And we could talk about a number of names. I won't do that right now, but we could talk about a number of names of people who have stepped up and stepped in to our lives, that we didn't know very well in some cases, but we've gotten to know them better through all of this. And a lot of the people that you sort of expect to be with you and to walk with you through this are sort of nowhere to be found.
That's in part
because it seems to me that nobody wants to sort of confront that, the horror of, you know, let's just go to church and to celebrate and praise God and the goodness of God. God's always good. And, you know, you hear those kind of things. But in fact, church sometimes doesn't help us do the hard work of lamenting, right?
Yeah. So a big part of this book is to do what I call a double witness, which is to witness to one another's lament as Christians. So witness to that, witness to the loss, witness to the grief, be there. And at the same time, and as appropriate, witness to the hope that we have as Christians. But we need to do the double witness. We need to witness the laments and witness the hope. Sometimes some of our friends only want to witness to the hope we have.
Right.
And they want to move too quickly to that. This book draws on a lot of psychological and psychiatric and social studies to talk about what trauma entails, what recovery requires. So I'm trying to marry the theological with the psychological and the social data so that we might have a healthy approach to how we help one another recover from horrors and trauma. And David, your point about God accompanying us through people God working in our lives through others is one of the unique things about God being the Trinity, because as he indwells you and other people, he can, as Paul writes in 2 Corinthians, he can put his concern for one person into another Christian's heart, and he can lead that other Christian to care for them. So Paul is cared for by someone into whom God puts a concern for Paul, and that person comes alongside him and cares for him, as he writes about in 2 Corinthians. And it can happen on a community level. You know, there's a collection being taken up for the Jerusalem Christians, because knows what the needs are of the Jerusalem Christians. So he gets others to very generously pull together this collection for their needs. So God, because he's God the Trinity and indwells us all as Christians, he can send at the right time the right person. So it means that God's care is a kind of care that we may experience that goes above and beyond what someone who is not a Christian can expect. So I actually mount an argument that as Trinitarian Christians, we have God on our side in the wake of horrors, and actually our recovery may be of a different quality and kind to the people around us who live without God. So it's an argument for the goodness of God in the midst of horrors.
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, one of the things you talked about in the book, and I think it was toward the end of the book, is about the fact that sometimes the work that we do or the things that we do creates harm. And it creates trauma for others.
Yeah.
So what advice would you give for those who need to ask forgiveness for the harm that they've done?
Yeah. So in the book, I write about survivors and surviving horror makers and horrors and the trauma that accompanies that. But also, as you say, David, I also write about horror makers. Mm-hmm. Those of us who've done terrible things to others, and we might not realize at the time when we mercilessly, for example, bullied a sibling or had a really inappropriate relationship with a boyfriend or girlfriend in high school or college, and it's only now that we're realizing the damage we've done. What do you do? There's a whole literature around this, and it relates to what's called a moral injury, where you are shocked by the things that you've done. There's a lot of grief and guilt and shame there, and it's very difficult for us to confront that. And it's very difficult for us to communicate with, apologize, ask for forgiveness from those persons, because often it's in the past. We also worry, for example, that they might then contact our employer, take us to court, be manipulative with the information. So it calls for a lot of wisdom and discernment. But I think what's vital for Christians is that we're united to Christ, and he is the most righteous person and safe attachment that we have. Beginning with prayer with him and with other trusted Christians, we can all begin this process of dealing with the fact that many of us actually are horror makers. I can attest to the fact that dealing with what we have done does set you free. The truth does set you free, and dealing with what we've done in the past really opens us up to flourish as God's images and as gifts to others. You know, if we're ministering out of a place that includes terrible shame and a fear of being found out one day, it's very different to ministering out of a place where we're open and there's an overflow of a heart that's been forgiven and we've dealt with a lot of what we've done. Dealing with moral injury and being a horror maker is really important for Christians, for the kind of ministries and families that we can have. So it's a very important part of the book.
So it's an important part of our past, but also our future, right? Yeah. I mean, it seems to be that. One of the big items that you deal with is the Gospel of Matthew. And you give, I think the term was a horror reading of Matthew. So first of all, why Matthew? And what does it mean to use a horror reading or horror hermeneutic or something? What does that mean? That just seems strange.
Sure. Yeah, look, it does seem strange. So in the book, what I'm trying to do is, the best way to deal with theodicy is through stories rather than abstract concepts. Let's deal with Matthew, kind of the first gospel that's also very Trinitarian as well. So let's deal with that. But what I want to do first, it's for people who aren't survivors of horrors and trauma, it's to help those readers to develop empathy. That is, I would like to go through a horror reading of Matthew to show you, the reader, what a gospel like Matthew might look like to someone who survived horrors and trauma. In the psychological literature, they talk about a paranoid reading. And that's not to denigrate survivors, but it's to say that survivors often anticipate in their life and the world around them the terrible things that they have experienced. So let me give you a very concrete example. I was mentoring a very young Christian reading Matthew's gospel. He was, I didn't know it at the time, he was a survivor of sexual abuse himself. When we read the story of the virginal conception and the birth of Jesus, all he was able to focus on was the slaughter of the innocents, because his life experience led him to pick up on terrible things that happen. He wasn't being difficult. He wasn't doing that to side rail the Bible study. It's just what he saw in the text.
Right, right.
I do a horror reading of Matthew's gospel to help those of us who are not survivors to have empathy for those who will read the Bible in a very, very different way. After doing the horror reading, I focus on the verse where Jesus makes a contrast between an understanding of himself, which is flesh and blood, in Matthew 16. And he says to Peter, flesh and blood haven't revealed to you that I am the Son of the living God, but the living God has revealed who I am. And I say that, look, we have these horror readings that come from our experience, but that's just stopping at the level of flesh and blood. That's the gory reading that comes from our experience. But with God, there may be the beginning of a reparative, renewing reading of Matthew's gospel, where we read it not through the lens of flesh and blood, but through the lens of the living God who seeks to give us life.
Which is the hope-filled reading, right? Or the blessed reading.
Which is the hope-filled reading. So the horror reading is really there to help us have empathy for one another. And it's the flesh and blood reading, which is the contrast to what follows, which is a hope-filled reading of Matthew's gospel.
Talked to Dr. Scott Hauer about his book entitled God of All Comfort, A Trinitarian Response to the Horrors of This World. Now, Scott, let me just give you some real quick things to respond to. What is the role of ritual in terms of getting through and flourishing after trauma?
The role of ritual is that it helps us guide our bodies through a vital Christian practice, whether we want to do so or not. So after a difficult time in my life, I built a chapel here in the garage that you can see right now. And the idea of this little chapel is that I had to walk through it at the beginning of my day, and I had to stop. There's a place to kneel and pray. There's a picture of Jesus to remind me that he is the Lord. He is the Good Shepherd. And it was that ritual, that settled practice of having to kneel and pray before him at the beginning of the day, that gave me a helpful orientation. The Lord's Supper is a very helpful ritual that helps us Christians be reminded that this world and the lives that we live isn't it, that he is returning one day and that we have hope of new life and new beginnings. So rituals for me, and there are lots of kind of rituals we can build into our lives, are very helpful because it stops us when we're feeling overwhelmed from becoming fully overwhelmed. It gives us a place whereby our whole body is taught to respond well to the reality, which is that Jesus is Lord and our Good Shepherd.
One of the things I love about the Anglican Church, of which you're a minister, is the ritual itself and the liturgy, and to some degree the sameness and the reminders every week about confession and the creeds and the confessions and such that go along with that, and the Lord's Prayer and other things as well. Yeah. So second idea, community. What role does the community have in?
The role of a community in recovery is key, and a lot of psychological studies point that out. For Christians, because we're united with Christ, Christ will work through his body so that we are all built up to maturity, even in the wake of horrors. So Christian community is the instrument through which God will work, particularly to help us rebuild our lives. And then in time, survivors will be growing in Christlikeness so that they may become helpful gifts to other Christians. So it's in community where we are rebuilt and helped after horrors, and it's in community where we may, in time, go on to serve others and help them in their own recovery. So community is that place where we love God and one another in harmonious relations that to do with the kingdom of heaven. That's what the kingdom of God is. It's this place, this realm where we can love one another and rebuild one another in love as we become Christ-likeness and glorify God in the midst of a broken world.
This is a great book. I really encourage folks to see it and to go out and buy it and read it. All of us will experience the horrors of this world. If we haven't at the age of 30, we will at the age of 40 or 50, somewhere in there. Yeah. It's called The God of All Comfort, A Trinitarian Response to the Horrors of This World, written by Dr. Scott Hauerwer. Dr. Hauerwer, great. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate coming on.
Thanks to Brent Johnson and Janet Seifert for editing these podcasts. Thanks as well to Phil Keggy for our music. These podcasts are made possible by the generosity of Mark and Becky Lanier and the Lanier Theological Library Foundation. If you have questions, comments, or would just like to be in touch, please email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Lanier is L-A-N-I-E-R. Thanks for listening.